from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, Republican Senate Leader Randy Richardville wants to change term limits in Michigan.
These are the most restrictive term limits in the United States.
But
Randy Richardville can talk about messing with them, but Randy Richardville hasn't even been able to get the roads fixed.
Then food porn, food decathlons, celebrity chefs. When did food become entertainment?
Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about Americans having just a bounty of food and also eating really fast and these kind of meals where you'd just have, you know, just these vast feasts and people would just kind of shovel it in, and that being a strikingly American phenomenon.
And a bad movie gets a bad movie review, but a bad bottle of wine? Not so much.
There's just too much out there that's good these days to be concentrating on a lot of the bad stuff.
Those stories and more. Michigan voters okayed term limits more than 20 years ago. Some say they've been a disaster.
Term limits have rendered the legislature almost totally dysfunctional.
But they remain popular. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the problems term limits have created and how one Republican lawmaker thinks he can fix them.
I think most people that listen to the proposal like it.
But first, 6 weeks from today, we'll be going through November election results. Michigan will have a new U.S. senator, and voters will have either given Governor Rick Snyder another term or elected Democrat Mark Schauer. 6 weeks from today will also mean the beginning of the state's lame duck legislative session. Lame duck, that period of time after the November election, but before a new year begins with new lawmakers. Now, the last time lame duck came up in the Michigan legislature, it brought us the passage of right to work. So what are we going to see this year? Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He is also my co-host of It's Just Politics. Hi, Rick.
Ta-da.
So when we talk with the Republican leaders who, you know, are pretty much running the show right now in Lansing, they say they don't have huge, big plans that will surprise everyone for lame duck. Are folks buying that?
No. they're not. At the very least, you know, there's the suspicion, and a lot of it is rooted in what happened in the last lame duck session when all of a sudden right to work got legs and ran. That there's going to be, you know, something, you know, that comes up out of the blue. The biggest one that comes up would be what's called electoral college reform, that Republicans will try to do something in anticipation of the coming presidential cycle to make Michigan more competitive in terms of helping the Republican win electoral votes in Michigan. In the last six presidential elections, the Democrats have always won, which means under Michigan's winner-take-all system, they've also gotten all 16 electoral votes.
Right, and because so, Michigan is winner-take-all. So let's talk a little bit about what Republicans are talking about, which is an idea that instead of a winner-take-all electoral college system, it would be based on congressional districts, and because of how Michigan has been so gerrymandered.
That's
example,
a judgmental term, not a legal term, because gerrymandering is illegal.
Right. Like what we all like to say are most likely gerrymandered districts. Mm-hmm. What that would mean, for example, is, you know, if this was in effect in 2012, that Mitt Romney
would have won more electoral votes, even though Barack Obama won the popular vote here in Michigan. Now, we should point out, though, that really, you know, House Speaker Jace Bolger has said that this is something that he thinks deserves to be, you know, talked about. Governor Snyder has publicly expressed himself to be at least lukewarm on the idea that you know, this is something that should be, you know, bipartisan, you know, hinting that it shouldn't be rammed through in something like a lame duck session, that Senate Majority Randy Richardville has said similar things. But I guess, you know, if you want to look at the lame duck session sort of writ larger, it will depend a lot on what Governor Rick Snyder would like to get done before the end of this term. And there are really three things on his list, and they are number one, road funding, number two, road funding, number three, road funding.
No, he also told me last week the fourth was road funding also. You're missing
it. Yep. And it's five, six, seven, and eight. So anything that contributes toward getting transportation funding done in the lame duck session would have to be given some serious consideration. So bring in electoral college reform, and then, you know, whatever else might be out there. We should point out that 11 state senators, you know, members of the state house, will not be coming back because of term limits, because they ran for something else, because they just decided to retire. And that's before we get to the results of the November elections. And anything and everything that those exiting lawmakers would like to get done while they still have the power and privilege of being a voting member of the Michigan legislature would also, you know, potentially go on to the agenda. And, you know, I mean, just to give you an example, that the Michigan Vehicle Code is typically something that gets a bill to amend that typically gets very, very large in the closing days of a session.
Right. I mean, you know, this month we saw Talk Like a Pirate Day was okayed in the Michigan legislature on the House.
That actually gets that has now become a regular event. It gets okayed every year.
So, Rick, could we see some of these issues, for example, road funding, electoral college? Could we actually see some horse trading about what gets done and what doesn't?
Governor Snyder famously does not do horse trading with the legislature on issues. He does do things that seem an awful lot like horse trading, but because he says it's not horse trading, of course it's not. You sit down and you have a dialogue, you find out what's on everybody's to-do list, you find out what things on those to-do lists are acceptable, one, and two, you know, get you to the number of votes that you need.
Rick, in 2012, there were sort of rumblings before lame duck that right to work could get passed. Are there other rumblings of issues? One thing that I'm thinking about, for example, is prevailing wage. Democratic leader Tim Grimmel says that's something he's worried about, that Republicans might try to do something about.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a right to work hangover that, you know, right after making Michigan a right to work state, doing something about the prevailing wage law, the one that says that public contractors have to pay the prevailing local union wage, has always been high on the Republican target list. And so Democrats are wondering, you know, what is in play? What might get thrown down during lame duck session, especially if the Republicans lose their hegemony in Lansing, lose the reality that they control the Senate, the House, and the governor's office, have a majority on the state Supreme Court, and then all of a sudden things that they might want to do in the coming session won't be quite as doable as they once were.
What does this say about where our system is at, that lame duck is sort of when things are getting pushed through or getting done? Is this just sort of the new normal?
Actually, I would submit to you that it is the old normal, that lame duck is always where, you know, has always been a place where a lot of, you know, issues that are either too controversial to deal with before the election land or too inconsequential to deal with until after the election land, especially when you've got a lot of people who are going to be departing for one reason or another. If you've got a small number of departing legislators, lame duck can be kind of manageable because you don't have a lot of last minute asks. If you've got a lot of lawmakers departing, like we will this year, then, you know, lame duck becomes, you know, more of a grab bag with a lot of people trying to get stuff done before they leave. And, you know, quite frankly, just not everybody gets their wish.
Finally, Rick, we should absolutely say, you know, we're talking quite a bit about Republicans because they control the legislature, executive branch. But let's be pretty clear that if Democrats were in charge during lame duck, they would most likely do the same thing, push through policy issues that they want.
The philosophy and operations of a lame duck session really don't have a particular partisan makeup. The Democrats and Republicans handle the opportunities and challenges of the post-election session pretty much the same way.
Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, also my co-host of It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio. Rick, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Zoe.
You might have heard recently about the Truth Squad at Bridge Magazine. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham has been working with the Truth Squad. They're teaming up and looking at political ads this election cycle. letting voters, letting us know what's true in these ads, what's not true, and definitely what's been a little dodgy. Tomorrow, Lester will talk with us about why it's a good idea somebody is looking at these ads and about the ratings Truth Squad hands out. Here's an example of some of the work you might have recently heard.
Three of them did not earn a foul from the Truth Squad, but this fourth one earned a flagrant foul.
Mark Schauer is a politician who has made wrong, expensive choices. Some defy reason.
And by the way, just today, the Truth Squad ruled a flagrant foul on a fake news site that the GOP put up in an effort to influence voters in Michigan's 7th congressional district. That race is between Republican Congressman Tim Walberg and Democratic challenger Pam Burns. Lester reported on that fake news site a couple of weeks ago. Daniel Scarpinato is the national press secretary for the National Republican Congressional Committee. He told Michigan Radio people won't confuse the online postings with news sites.
These aren't news sites. They are, and they're not fake. They're real attack websites. They're real political attack websites. They're not meant to be news sites, and they're not news sites.
A national news organization, however, disagrees. Mike Cavender is the executive director of the Radio Television Digital News Association. Cavender says the website crosses a line.
Masquerading as news information is simply unethical.
Cavender says these websites look like news sites, and he says political operatives should not be using the credibility of journalists to bolster their attacks on one another. The Truth Squad said the flagrant foul ruling is one of the easier Michigan Truth Squad calls of this political season. Again, tune in to Stateside tomorrow. Lester Graham will join us, and we will talk about all of the good, the bad, the dirty political ads that we've seen so far this election season. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. When did food become entertainment? Celebrity chefs and television stations devoted to food 24 hours a day. Dozens and dozens of slick magazines all about food. Margot Finn focuses on food studies at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Margot.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we actually started talking about this because there was an article about Fifth Third Ballpark in West Michigan. And the stadium made news years ago because of the Fifth Third burger. It's a burger that's like bigger than your head, almost 5,000 calories. And then the stadium this summer had the food decathlon where you got a punch card and were rewarded by eating all of this food, including the Baco, which is a taco. But instead of a tortilla, it's bacon. Obviously.
Oh, obviously.
Or the deep-fried hot dog wrapped in potato chips because it makes it so much easier to just take one bite instead of having to, like,
that
have the two separate.
That sounds kind of good.
I know, right? So when did this shift happen, Margot, from food as nutrition and sustenance to food as, you know, sport or entertainment?
I think you'd have to go really far back if there was even a moment where there was a shift at all. I think food has probably always been both a form of nutrition and a form of entertainment. I mean, whether it was people gathering around a fire and sharing food with each other,
right.
And establishing all kinds of social hierarchies through the practices that they were using, mm-hmm. to religious feasting and fasting. Mm-hmm. Food has had a lot of different meanings for a long time. It's never just been sustenance, I don't think.
And yet there does feel like a difference between, let's say, food in a religious aspect or something like that, or bringing a community together, like, you know, having a potluck versus what we're talking about, a food decathlon. So help me understand that line there, at least.
Sure. Well, I mean, there is a long tradition of competitive eating, too. That's
yeah.
not a new phenomenon.
Okay.
It may have become more popular at various times and places, but I mean, we have records in American newspapers of eating competitions that go back at least to the 1700s.
What food were they eating?
In that case, it was the one that I'm thinking of, it was ginger cakes. So there were a couple of guys in Yorktown, Pennsylvania,
uh-huh.
I think, who, if they could eat 24 ginger cakes, I have no idea what these looked
what
like,
size?
How big they were, are they cookies, are they, who knows, then they could have them for free. So it's kind of an early man versus food.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the 76-ounce steak that if you eat the whole thing, it's free. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so food as entertainment, then it sounds like it's always been a phenomenon in our society, mm-hmm. but it still seems seems like there's been a shift in at least the size and the scope, as we talked about, you know, television channels devoted to food. And then, of course, like the food porn craze on Instagram, where everyone needs to show everyone else what they're eating for lunch. So when did that take a foothold?
Well, I think that there has been a proliferation of popular interest in food, or maybe a change in the nature of it, a kind of spectacular interest in food since maybe the late 70s, 1980s, I would place the kind of the current rise of, and that's where you see the rise of interest in gourmet and the increasing interest in natural food, mm-hmm. and to some extent the rise of, you know, through, I guess, more in the 90s, celebrity chefs, so Meryl being one of the early ones, mm-hmm. and I can't even think, Wolfgang Puck, I guess,
right.
may have been
sure.
kind of early.
We've had Mario Batali on the program, in fact. So what was going on then in this period of time that suddenly this came to the forefront of sort of popular culture?
Well, a lot of things were going on. I think it had a lot to do with shifts in class structure that went on at that time. So you've got the middle class stagnating or declining, the very rich kind of pulling away. And so I think there's a way in which food becomes a performative arena for people to express a kind of aspirational identity, a way to make yourself seem better, perhaps, the kind of attempting to, if not ape the culture of the rich, at least to eat in a way that you think is going to make you seem distinctive and better. It's not that food wasn't a form of entertainment before, but maybe it looked a little different to us because the ways you might try to eat to be, there was more, I guess, of a eating like your neighbors rather than trying to eat different from your neighbors. So a shift in emphasis, which doesn't mean that food was new as a kind of class performance, but the way people were performing class through food might have shifted.
Well, that's funny you bring that up. I remember my parents in the early 80s going out to a sushi restaurant for the first time, and that seeming like this really big deal among their friends.
Yeah, the explosion of ethnic food is also something that happens, I think, you know. So it starts a little bit earlier, but in the 70s, we see more of people doing enclave eating, so eating within their ethnic group or trying to rediscover their ethnicity through food. And in the 1980s and 1990s, you see people doing more exploration. So instead of eating your own background, now you're eating other people's background.
Right. Well, okay, so speaking of other backgrounds, I mean, how American is this idea of food as entertainment? Do we see this in other countries and other cultures?
We definitely see it in other countries and other cultures. The one that comes to mind really readily is Japan, both because competitive eating is a really big deal there, with probably one of the most famous competitive eaters is actually from Japan, Kobayashi, who had a string of victories at Nathan's hot dog eating contest that made him famous, I think.
There were the YouTube videos that like everyone saw.
He pioneered the method that now almost all of the really serious competitive eaters use, where they dunk the food in water, because that helps them just kind of let it slide down their throat rather than having to take the time to chew, which slows you down if you're trying to eat 60 hot dogs in 10 minutes.
Obviously, just stop chewing.
Yeah, the more you can just swallow, Americans, there is a kind of long association of kind of bolting your food or this kind of really fast gluttonous eating in America. Some people attribute that to a way of distinguishing Americans even in 17th, 18th centuries from the Europeans, the idea that Americans were kind of trying to not be pretentious, not have fussy formal meals, and so the idea that you would just bolt your food was almost a patriotic act. Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about Americans having just a bounty of food and also eating really fast, and these kind of meals where you'd just have, just these vast feasts and people would just kind of shovel it in, and that being a strikingly American phenomenon.
Which is so interesting because, you look at maybe the French or something and the idea of having, a 3-hour dinner and so many courses and looking down their nose at Americans for doing just that, for not necessarily enjoying the taste and the smells.
Right. Or not having the languorous meal versus the kind of, but that's a different kind of, people associate that with a kind of decadence too, mm-hmm. right? The kind of the Italian meal where you go on for hours and there is a million courses. There's a lot of food in those instances too. It's just not, I guess, eaten as quickly.
And that's another argument, I guess, here in the States with fast food. So many people, eating either in, having meals, either in their cars or maybe just even at their desks at work.
Although fast food is popular around the world, too.
Sure.
So, McDonald's is a global phenomenon.
So I want to kind of shift our conversation because, we're talking about all of this. And I think we have to bring up obesity rates that are just sort of skyrocketing here.
Well,
my question is, the American Medical Association classified obesity as a disease these last year.
Controversially.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that controversy and how that feeds into this idea that it seems like you can't turn on the TV without seeing advertisements for unhealthy food.
And weight loss dieting at the same time, right?
Right.
So this idea that obesity is still skyrocketing, there's some real questions about that. Certainly, American weight increased between 1980 and 2000. It's quite unclear whether or not obesity has increased since 2000. So there's a lot of people who argue, and there's a lot of statistics to back up the idea that, in fact, obesity began to stabilize at around the moment, actually, that people started getting concerned about it.
Hmm.
So, you know, if you look at weights from, I think, it like 2002 to 2012, I don't know that we've got data since then.
Okay.
This is data that's hard to collect.
Right.
But you don't see any statistically significant increase for most demographics. And actually, for children ages 2 to 5, there was a statistically significant decrease in weight.
And this goes to the idea, my guess, is that it's becoming part of sort of a forefront of issues. And we're hearing doctors talk more about it. I mean, is it just because people are talking more about it?
It's a very good question why that's happened. A lot of people think that it's probably not any change in, say, public health policy, in part because the stabilization, if it did start happening around 1999-2000, would have happened at around the same time that the real concern in obesity started. So that stagnation in some ways happened too early for it to be attributed to the kind of rise of concern that's happened since then.
We're speaking with Margot Finn. She focuses on food studies at the University of Michigan, talking about food as entertainment and obesity here in the U.S. So help me understand then how we can make sense of this food as entertainment culture alongside growing concern of obesity, plus the economic impacts. I mean, groups are making hundreds of millions of dollars on weight loss drugs and weight loss opportunities. What does that look like for the economy right now?
There's certainly lots of people profiting off of the immense and just the vast desire to lose weight. That's a giant industry, billions of dollars. I don't know the exact figures, but yeah, billions of dollars spent every year on weight loss efforts. I don't know how connected these things are. So look at a country like Japan. Again, a really vast cultural interest in food, a long history of interest in food. They've got competitive eating there too. That's quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lowest rates of obesity in the developed world. I think their obesity rate is, I think I saw recently a stat that it was around 3%.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that necessarily the interest in food tracks with obesity in a really meaningful way. In the U.S., what you might say, this is speculative,
yeah,
you might say that some of the interest in food and the interest and concern about fatness come from that same place of people looking for ways to distinguish themselves and aspire. So maybe some of the panic about obesity, again, has to do with this idea that we associate thinness with richness.
Mm-hmm.
And so the desire to be thin and the desire to pursue weight loss techniques, most of which are not proven to actually result in long-term weight loss,
yeah,
Is another way for people to try to aspire, to try to perform a kind of class identity.
Right, which is so interesting, too, this idea of being thin and remaining thin as a sign of wealth as compared with hundreds and hundreds of years ago, nowhere kings and queens liked to be overweight. Isn't that the case? Because it sort of showed that they had the money to be able to keep eating as much as they wanted?
Yeah, I mean, I think the picture is complicated even there. But yeah, there's certainly some, there are some cultural contexts, even still, where being fat and being able to have fat is a sign of status, is a sign of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's usually gendered. Sometimes it's contingent on marital status. So there's some places where it's good to be thin if you're young, but then once you're married, you want to be fat to show that your husband can provide. So it's a complicated picture, at least. But now, certainly in the U.S., it's very true that we associate thinness with wealth. And that's, there's some demographic backing to that, too. It does seem that poverty is associated more strongly with obesity. But mm-hmm. but there are fat people in every income bracket.
Right,
there are thin
course.
People in every income bracket.
So let's look ahead sort of towards the future. I mean, where do you see this sort of going, this idea of food as entertainment that we see in modern day? I mean, what does that look like in your mind, you think, in 5 years or 10 years?
That is such a hard question. Predicting the future it's just a problem.
It could be a dangerous game.
I mean, I expect food to continue to be a form of entertainment. I think people will continue taking all kinds of pleasure and having all kinds of anxiety about what they're eating. You know, I wonder a little bit how the kind of the post-recession and the kind of long stagnation, particularly in employment, might affect the overall picture of food entertainment. But it's really hard to say in what way that might change or affect anything.
I wonder if there's a time where food becomes less sexy and it goes back to being what we just use for sustenance and less about all of these extra contexts.
I don't know. I mean, looking at the very long history of kind of spectacular feasts and competitive eating, pie eating contests at carnivals, food advertisements and food entertainment, cooking, I find it hard to believe that food could ever be simply, I don't know, a source of whatever gets you through the day. We've used food in kind of complex and multivarious ways for a very long time. I don't expect that to end.
Margo Finn studies food and all issues related to food and our culture at the University of Michigan. Margo, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's continue talking all things food and drink, particularly the latter. Critic Chris Cook was recently asked why he doesn't write about bad wine.
It's partially policy, and it's partially what we think the public wants to hear.
Cook is the food and wine critic at Our Detroit Magazine.
They really don't want to hear about bad things. I mean, in the magazine anyway, you don't pick it up and open the pages to read about something bad. You want to find something good.
I loved how you opened up the article, which was a woman that just came up to you and said, why don't you ever do those type of reviews? Now, movie reviewers will write terrible pieces about bad movies. Food critics are known for being pretty brutal at times. Why is wine different?
I don't think it is necessarily different. In some cases, and I'm not just talking about Our here, I'm talking about newspapers in general, who wants to read about something that's bad? The exception being that if it is a very high-end wine, and that, I think, was what this woman was getting to in part. I just think that there's just too much out there that's good these days to be concentrating on a lot of the bad stuff. In the wine world in particular, the technology has gotten so good that the wines are much, much better than they used to be. So making the distinction between good and bad is less important now, I think, than it used to be.
Although you do write, and as you just said, that every once in a while you will let folks know when something is just bad, when you've opened up a bottle and it is no good. What has to happen to make that happen?
Well, the example I used was a 1990s Chateau Aubryon, which had a very, very heavy fungal aroma. That's something that happened in the winery that shouldn't have happened with Aubryon, particularly. It's a very high-end Bordeaux wine, very expensive. But it was so excessive that it went beyond the pale of just being barnyard-like, which a lot of people find pleasant. I do not. But then that sets up the question of where personal taste comes in to what you're reading in a wine and how, you know, is it bad or is it a personal taste issue too? So it's a very fine line.
You wrote about that you sort of took on this, who am I to tell you what a proper wine is to drink if you're not all that fond of it anyway?
Right. Because of I've done this for a long time, I distinguish a lot more than many other people would in wine. And I'm very alert to flaws in wine and things that should are not correct in the wine. So I make those distinctions when I analyze a wine, and in the case of whether it's Bordeaux or anywhere, I believe that they shouldn't be there. However, there are people who find that to be an asset. They like it in their wine, and okay, I'm not going to buy that wine. I'm not going to drink it particularly, but if some people like it, they like it.
Chris, finally, in the last minute or two that we have here, we've been so negative. Let's talk a little positivity. This is the first week of fall. What bottles are you getting excited as the weather cools off a little bit?
Well, interestingly, I every time the fall rolls around, I'm rolling out of the whites and into the reds.
Sure.
At this time, we're right around tailgate season, so I'm in the lighter style reds and Pinot Noir at this particular time. By the time it gets to Thanksgiving, I'm looking at something a little bit bigger. And Christmas and New Year's, oh, you can talk to me about Malbecs and things like that, those big inky wines.
Well, we'll obviously have you back once it gets a little colder to talk about those. I'm assuming you are not drinking those tailgate wines out of red solo cups.
Oh, you can drink it out of anything you want, actually, Zoe. But no, I don't.
Chris Cook is food and wine critic at Detroit Hour magazine. His piece in the October issue is all about why he doesn't review bad wines. Chris, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We always want to hear from you here at Stateside. Okay, maybe not particularly about a bad wine that you've recently had, but instead, how about what stories you think we should be covering or what issues you want to hear more about? You can find us on Twitter. We're at Stateside Radio, or we're on Facebook. You can also find us at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside, and while you're there, you can check out stories you may have missed. There's been talk in Lansing about whether term limits should be extended. That talk is heating up. Michigan voters approved term limits for state lawmakers back in 1992. But Republican Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville thinks maybe it's time they're extended. Senator Richardville, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Senator, polls show that term limits are still popular among Michigan voters. Why change them?
Well, these are the most restrictive term limits in the United States. Others that were part of that movement back in the early 90s have either rescinded or changed their term limits. And, you know, every 20, 25 years or so, maybe it's a good idea to take a look at legislation and see if it makes sense. It's not that we're looking to eliminate term limits, just looking to extend them in what I think is a pretty reasonable kind of way, where voters would have a choice as to whether somebody could run an extra term. But we're not looking to throw the baby out with the bathwater just to change the bathwater.
Talk to me a little bit about your thinking about extending them. You've said that lawmakers would have to go around and maybe get a certain amount of signatures from voters within their district, would then submit those signatures as sort of proof that, hey, folks want me still in office.
So what I would do in this case, a lot of people, the feedback that I get often is, yeah, we like term limits, and we don't trust those people in office for an entire career. We don't want career politicians.
Mm-hmm.
But my guy's okay. My woman's okay. Whoever is representing me seems okay. So we can extend that there. And, you know, I live in the district that John Dingell represented. So I had a lot of people that would say that. And John won, I don't know, 27, 28 elections, something in that neighborhood. Term limits were deemed unconstitutional by the federal government, the United States Supreme Court, for federal offices. And what I'm looking to do is, today you can be recalled. In other words, if somebody doesn't think you're doing a good job, they can go around your district and get 20% of this, a number equivalent to 20% of the people that voted in the last gubernatorial election, and put you on a ballot to have you recalled and voted out of office. So I think it's only reasonable if you also say, well, if somebody wants to run an extra term beyond term limits in the Senate, and this person can go out and get 20% of the people that voted in the last election to say that's a good idea, they can have their name back on the ballot one more time. I think it's good for people, and I've got a lot of positive feedback on this proposal.
And yet you will hear from people who say this just sort of feeds into the perception that lawmakers just want to keep their jobs, keep their benefits, as you said, will sort of do whatever it takes to be so-called, you know, career politicians.
Yeah, well, let me be clear. I haven't had a raise in my salary in about 12 years. There is no pension. There is no retirement pension in the Michigan legislature. Congress has that, and others have it, but not in the Michigan legislature. And I make considerably less than I did before I ever ran for office. I do this because I love the job, I love the work, and I hope that I can do good things for the people of the state of Michigan. But I'm not going to run again. That's why I'm taking this ball and running with it, because I have no intention of coming back into the legislature in Michigan, even should this pass. But I just think that because of the institution and what I've learned and being a member of this institution, that it would be a better representation of people if we had that.
You'd need to get 2/3 support in both the state house and the Senate to pass this. Do you have that kind of support among lawmakers?
I think most people that listen to the proposal like it. I'm also going to put things on there like, you know, that don't exist today. If you don't show up to work, you don't get paid. If you don't get the budget passed by a certain time, then we're going to dock your pay for that, too. Just responsible kinds of things for people in everyday jobs that have the same kind of rules or restrictions. You're going to do that too. So it's a little bit of an overhaul of the system. When I was a freshman in the House, I came up here and didn't know very much about government at all. The difficulty is that when I went to talk to somebody who was the chairman of the Agriculture Committee, for instance, he'd only been here for 2 years. Or if I went to talk to the chairman of the Economic Development Committee, that person had no experience either. So there aren't the go-to kind of people up here because term limits eliminates those people every couple of years. So it's not just the new people that are coming into the legislature, but those that have been around are still learning.
One of the issues that folks talk about is that term limits has put too much power in the hands of lobbyists. The lobbyists become sort of institutional in Lansing, that they actually better understand how things work at the state capitol than the newbie lawmakers. Lobbyists have too much power in Lansing because of term limits?
Well, you know, there are really good lobbyists, there are average lobbyists, and there's not such good lobbyists. So lobbyists do play a part here in helping to educate legislators. But sometimes that education is biased based on who they're representing. So it's not just the lobbyists that have more information and more quote-unquote power, but it's the bureaucrats, too, those that have been up here for a long time. So the voice of the people, I don't think we want to silence or we want to weaken. Instead, I think we ought to make it stronger so that people are represented the way they should be.
It sounds like if this is taken up, it would be taken up in lame duck. If it doesn't get taken up in lame duck, would you consider putting it directly on the ballot?
I would have no problem with that. I think, again, once people are educated as to what we're talking about, there's no self-serving thing here. It's all about representing the people in a better way than what the initial plan back in 1990 or so called for. I'm going to do the best I can, but if it had to go straight to the ballot, I'd have no problem with that.
Republican Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So let's turn to Jack Lessenberry now, Michigan Radio's political analyst. Hey, Jack.
Hello, Zoe.
So, Jack, there's this interesting dichotomy, right, where you talk to those in politics who cover politics and you ask them what are the biggest problems in Lansing, and they'll say gerrymandered districts and term limits. And yet you talk to voters and they remain in favor of term limits.
Well, that's because voters don't really understand how this all works. That's been true from the beginning. In fact, when term limits were passed in 1992, most voters voted for them, I believe, because they thought they were going to be able to get rid of congressmen they didn't like. That's how the law was written. But, of course, a federal court said that Michigan had no authority to meddle with the terms of federal office holders. So people, they see people there they don't like, and they say, well, at least we can get rid of them. What people don't realize, because they have real lives and real jobs and they're very busy, is that term limits have rendered the legislature almost totally dysfunctional.
Although, haven't term limits sort of just exacerbated a problem that was already there? I mean, this issue that lawmakers aren't getting along, that there's too much influence from lobbyists. I mean, if we repealed them or changed them, those things would still go on, wouldn't they?
Not at the same level. I covered the legislature sporadically in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It was an entirely different place. Sure, you always had influence of lobbyists, but it's sort of the difference between having a sunburn and having skin cancer. What you had before term limits is you had a core of people on both sides who had been there 20 years, 30 years. It was their profession at some level, loyal to the institution and to Michigan. Took precedence over partisanship. They knew how to get things done. They were experienced. Did you have some people who'd stay there way too long? Of course you did. But you have that in Congress, and the constitutions of both Michigan and the federal government provide for the best possible term limits, which were elections.
Randy Richardville, he's talking about extending them, that lawmakers would go out in their districts, get a number of signatures in order to run again. I mean, in your mind, does that work, or should we just sort of get rid of them altogether?
I think you need to get rid of them altogether, but sadly, nothing is going to happen that I can see. Randy Richardville can talk about messing with them, but Randy Richardville hasn't even been able to get the roads fixed, and the lobbyists and the special interest would pour in gazillions of dollars to defeat it with misleading advertising. They love term limits. In fact, I talked to a Republican congressman the other day from Ohio who said when he was a legislator in Ohio, which has less strict term limits, some lobbyists said, I don't have to pay attention to you. I'll be here in 2 years and you'll be gone. Hmm. And there's a whole lot of that. Plus, I once had a lawmaker tell me that it took him 6 years in the legislature to find out where all the bathrooms were. So, and that now after 6 years, they have to go. You need institutional memory. You need people who've been around for a long time. You certainly need a mix of new people, too. I'm not saying that, but term limits has been an unmitigated disaster. Anyone who knows anything about it will tell you that. It hasn't even gotten that much new blood in. We just play, politicians play musical chairs with each other, and it fosters corruption.
Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. Jack, thank you so much.
Next time, I'll tell you what I really think.
As an article in the New York Times put it this week, Alaskans stay in Alaska. People in the Midwest and the Pacific Northwest sit tight. That's the message, at least, from climate change researchers who are predicting what places in the U.S. will be hit hardest by climate change. It looks like the Midwest will be all right, relatively speaking. Matthew Kahn is a professor at the UCLA Institute of Environment and the Department of Economics and Public Policy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Professor, if predictions are correct, what will the Midwest feel like in, say, 100 years?
Unfortunately, I won't be around to verify this prediction. But what the Midwest has going for it, and I was born there, is being relatively to the north in the U.S. and being off the coasts. And so there's many major cities in the Midwest. In a future urbanized world, we could build even bigger cities. So I think in terms of geographic determinism, that's my short answer.
In your book, Climatopolis, you actually predict that millions and millions of people will likely move to these areas. You say in some 80, 90 years, Detroit could become a really popular city.
It's quite possible. 3% of Americans switch states every year, and cities across the United States compete for young people and jobs. Right now, you can trade a Los Angeles home in my neighborhood near UCLA for 100 Detroit homes. And I've asked, could that be a good deal? And there's scenarios where climate change shakes up the ratings of quality of life across America's cities, and that cities like Detroit could compete much better in the future. And so my book actually strikes an optimistic tone that because we have so many choices of cities to live in the U.S. is such a large territory, that we can rebuild our cities on higher ground and in relatively safer places, and that this allows urbanites to continue to thrive, even though climate change is a very real threat.
Although you have to assume that you'll start seeing some sort of growing pains. I mean, you know, the idea that a city that might be used to, 500,000 people could suddenly see an influx of millions.
We've seen from both the case of Las Vegas and in China's cities the ability to build cities pretty quickly. Prefabricated housing, I realize that if a million people showed up in Detroit tomorrow, that there would be serious issues of accommodating all these individuals showing up. But the beauty of capitalism is that I think it would be a more orderly process, that it wouldn't be these environmental refugees like in a Mad Max movie. As we've seen, Phoenix and Las Vegas grow sharply over decades. Our real estate developers are looking to make profit. There might be gains to trade. Detroit has large swaths of open land where future Don Trumps could contract to build high-rise towers, and young people might want to buy there, and that's the beginnings of a city emerging.
At what point do we start seeing that change? I mean, right now, we're not seeing a huge trend of people moving because of climate change, but instead because of, you know, their jobs or because of family.
You've raised a crucial issue. In the Southwest right now, we're facing terrible drought conditions. And so if you pick up the Los Angeles Times, many of my UCLA colleagues are publishing pieces that we're already seeing climate change impact. And while millions of people have voted with their feet to live in Southern California and the Southwest, if rainfall really stops falling in the Southwest and we don't come up with ways to allocate water efficiently, you're going to see millions of households and thousands of firms looking across the United States for where are better places to live, less risky places to live. And the Midwest might compete very well there, just as it has in the past.
Matthew Kahn is the author of Climatopolis and professor at the UCLA Institute of Environment, the Department of Economics and Public Policy. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The 4th annual Detroit Design Festival is taking place this week with over 60 events. Sam O'Shelley is the sponsorship director at the Detroit chapter of the American Institute of Architects, the group putting on an event this Thursday evening at Eastern Market. And Detroit by Design event producer Rich Rice joins us as well. Sam, how do you align Detroit's architectural history and the backdrop of blight that's swallowing much of the city, you know, against what some may call an artistic renaissance? Can't this new, you know, artistic energy also bring with it some of the negatives that are associated with gentrification?
The golden age of Detroit was in the 20s and 30s. We were known as the Paris of the Midwest. People used to come here to study architecture and understand the buildings and the architecture of the era. And that building stock is some of our most important resources that we have in the region. So I think there's opportunity for new and to revitalize old.
Rich?
There's so much real estate there. You know, this used to be a city of almost 2 million people, and it's down to 700,000 now. I wouldn't look at it as gentrification at all. I would say it's a place that has the most capacity to allow space for everyone to develop.
How do you reconcile those sort of two narratives, the one of this sort of 5%, the city, the downtown that's being revitalized, and then the other, let's say, 90, 95% where there is blight and there is abandoned buildings? Can these two live together side by side?
Yeah, a number of years ago, AIA National, the American Institute of Architects National, set a grant aside to do a sustainability design assessment task force to come to Detroit. They brought in people from all over the U.S. that are experts in their fields to analyze this issue exactly that you're talking about. And what they really identified was that the way that Detroit is going to grow is that we have to impact the key villages and help each village kind of grow. So the midtowns, the core towns, the west villages, the central business district, as they kind of grow, they're going to kind of grow into each other. And that's how we can kind of take the growth that's happening in these key areas and start to build out and fill in some of the gaps that we now have.
What is the coolest thing? What is the thing that is getting each of you most excited right now when it comes to Detroit and design?
Well, for me, I am welcoming the opportunity to engage with the community more. You know, seeing how great design can impact the community and really change the lives of people in that neighborhood is really exciting to me. And I think there's just such a creative buzz downtown right now that everybody wants to be a part of it. It's sort of infectious.
For me, the buildings were always what drew me to Detroit. I grew up in Plymouth, and I spent a lot of time out in Ann Arbor. But coming out and seeing artists that have these, you know, 30,000 square foot spaces that they're working with, the history that's there on these buildings, you know, they have so much more character than these cookie cutter subdivisions.
Finally, for both of you, looking into the future, maybe a, you know, post bankruptcy, is there going to be, do you think, sort of a Detroit specific look or design that, you know, eventually the nation will recognize?
I think there's going to be definitely an edge to what the city looks like. I think it's going to be an interesting mix of showing old and new.
Rich?
Everyone's been invoking this. It feels like Brooklyn down here. And people talk about the arts movement, the older creatives, say, like back in the 80s in New York, it feels a lot like what was going on there. Definitely an energy here and opportunities here for artists that is catching a lot of attention internationally right now.
Looking at the future of architecture and design in Detroit, the 4th annual Detroit Design Festival is taking place this week across the city, running through Sunday. Sam O'Shelley is the sponsorship director at the Detroit chapter of the American Institute of Architects, and event producer Rich Rice is with Detroit by Design. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Zoe.
And that is Stateside. Find out more on the web, michiganradio.org. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.